The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
What gives me alarm about this case is the specter of that history repeating, which is to say, the prospect that you could have a John Doe detainee where, because the U.S. doesn't identify him, and because it does not provide him with access to counsel, and because it contests the ability of someone like the ACLU to litigate on his behalf, this litigation actually drags out for a while, whether or not the courts ultimately conclude that the government does or does not have the authority to detain him, right? That is to say, I'm alarmed by the specter of just how long the government could thwart, frustrate, or otherwise impede judicial review in a case like this, because I don't know what precedent that sets for next time. Indeed, one would have thought that the Jose Padilla case would have been a precedent for this time, except that it is no precedent.
I'm Vanessa Sauter, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 17th, 2017. When an American ISIS fighter turned himself in to Syrian Democratic Forces last month, the subsequent detention of the unnamed enemy combatant by U.S. forces sparked concern. To explore the implications of John Doe's detention, Steve Vladeck joined Benjamin Wittes for a lively debate on the level of alarm that the American citizen held in military custody should raise. They discuss the facts of the event, the reasons behind the failure to disclose John Doe's identity or provide him access to counsel, the legitimacy of his detention, and much more. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 253, Detaining an American Enemy Combatant.
Steve, let's start with just a basic agreed upon account of the issue as we face it. How would you describe the facts that we are going to discuss and debate right now?
So I guess there are three major facts that I think will inform this conversation. The first is that sometime roughly a month ago, a U.S. citizen whose name and identity we still don't know apparently turned himself in to Syrian Democratic Forces in Syria, so some of the rebels who are fighting Assad, who in turn turned that citizen over to us, at which point we began detaining him in the military as an enemy combatant, apparently in Iraq. So that's sort of the first big background fact. The second fact, and this is, I think, derived from the Charlie Savage, Eric Schmidt reporting in the New York Times, is that the U.S. is not sure what to do with him, which is to say, they're not sure that there's another country, for example, Iraq, that can prosecute him and take him off our hands. They're not sure if they have enough evidence to bring the citizen into the United States to stand trial in a civilian court on ordinary criminal charges, and they're also not sure they have enough evidence that might hold up in a habeas petition that might be brought on this U.S. citizen's behalf if and when someone's able to establish his identity, or at least that someone is able to act on his behalf. And I think the third fact, and perhaps the source of maybe the biggest, not disagreement between you and me, Ben, but sort of the biggest controversy, is that the U.S. is apparently refusing to identify this John Doe detainee and to allow him access to counsel or family members or anyone other than the Red Cross, at least in part to forestall, to delay, to drag out the habeas petition that has already been filed on his behalf by the ACLU in the D.C. District Court before Judge Chutkan, I think on the theory that the longer it takes for anyone to figure out who this guy is, the harder it's going to be for the ACLU or anybody else for that matter to prove that they are a next friend who would therefore have standing to vindicate his rights to be free from allegedly unlawful military detention. So, you know, I think those are the three principal facts, Ben, that get us to where we are. I wonder if you think that's comprehensive or if there's anything else you'd want to add.
There are a few factual nits I would pick with that account, and there are a couple things I would add. So let's see if we can come to a factual agreement. I largely agree with your account. A couple things. First of all, I have no reason to think that people, based on the New York Times account, that the government has anxieties that it would not be able to prevail in a habeas case on the factual merits of this guy's being an enemy combatant or an unprivileged belligerent, though I do agree with you that there's a substantial question as to whether, as a matter of law, ISIS would be covered by the relevant legal instruments, i.e. the AUMF. Secondly, I'm less confident than you are that the reason the name has been withheld is in order to frustrate litigation and drag it out and therefore buy time, as opposed to, for example, more routine operational security, not trying to complicate, for example, diplomatic efforts maybe to repatriate him to his other home country, or, you know, some other non-litigation-based reason to keep the name secret. The final thing is just a few factual amendments or additions. First of all, I think one of the interesting things about the New York Times story was that it asserted that this was not an ideological effort to kind of rehabilitate, you know, enemy combatant detentions a la Hamdi or Padilla, but was rather a situation where the military really did want to dump this guy into law enforcement custody. And the reason that this had not happened yet was that the Justice Department had anxieties about whether the evidence against him would be admissible in a criminal proceeding. And he had not played ball with the Warsami Protocol clean team approach, in which you kind of interrogate somebody for intelligence purposes and then bring in a different team, Mirandize him, and, you know, hopefully he confesses to everything and you have a basis for a prosecution. And so I do think part of the interesting background here is that while we've all been expecting, partly because the president was, you know, so flamboyant during the campaign about promising to bring bad hombres to Guantanamo and to lock a lot of people up and torture people, we've all been primed to expect a kind of new round of enemy combatant litigation for ideological reasons. In fact, this appears to be not that, but a reflection of a kind of a problem that could always have arisen and that involves a genuine seam between the lawful enemy combatant detentions that we're engaged in all the time and the criminal system, which is our preferred long-term dispositions.
So let me just say briefly, I agree completely on the last point, which is to say this is a case where the guy at issue literally walked in off the street. And so I completely agree that this is not of itself a harbinger of some massive policy development to come or a return to the bad old days of, you know, 2002, 2003. I think that's clear. That said, I mean, I think maybe this sort of starts getting to the two central points of disagreement between us. First, I actually suspect there is a fair amount of anxiety on the merits of the potential habeas petition for two reasons, right? First, I think it's not clear, and I think, Ben, you were you were alluding to this, that the AUMF covers ISIS at all. I think, you know, all things being equal, a contemporary federal court would be likely to conclude that the answer is yes in the abstract. But, and, you know, Bobby and I talked about this last week on the National Security Law podcast, plug intended.
Pause, Steve. I want to say to all listeners of the Lawfare podcast who are even remotely attracted to this discussion that you should be listening to the National Security Law podcast every week, even if you are not a sports fan and even if you don't care about Game of Thrones.
Well, you know, Game of Thrones is over, so at least that's out of the way. But just to finish the thought then, I mean, I think, you know, my concern – folks may remember from the Hamdi and Padilla litigation the strange creature that is the Non-Detention Act, which says that no citizen shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained except pursuant to an act of Congress. It's true, of course, that in Hamdi, a plurality of the court held that the AUMF satisfies that statute for purposes of battlefield captures in Afghanistan. But, you know, there are at least some justices who thought that the Non-Detention Act was more of a clear statement rule. And so if I'm the government, I don't know why I would want to litigate the merits of the ISIS question, which has huge ramifications for counterterrorism policy, in the context of an American citizen detainee. I mean, that's like just about the worst context for the government to litigate that question in. But second, and I think more significantly, I actually rather disagree with the suggestion that withholding John Doe's name is not really or even principally or even substantially about the litigation. I mean, yes, it's possible that there are sensitive diplomatic negotiations underway to try to repatriate him to whatever his other country of citizenship is, and or to try to find some other country to take him. But I don't know why notifying his family of who he is, that he's in U.S. custody, and that he's safe would be antithetical to those negotiations. I don't know why naming him would be antithetical to those negotiations. And indeed, I think it's worth stressing, the government never pulled this maneuver in the context of the early post 9/11 detainees, Hamdi, Padilla, etc. Padilla, they couldn't, because Padilla was already in material witness detention where everyone knew what was going on. John Ashcroft gave this press conference from Moscow where he told the world that Jose Padilla was being detained as enemy combatant. But even in Hamdi's case, as soon as the government transferred him from Guantanamo to Virginia, you know, his family was notified. His father brought his habeas petition. And so I guess I'm not nearly as confident that this has as little as Ben suggests to do with trying to sort of postpone or at least forestall for the time being the habeas case.
Right. So I'm just to be clear, I'm not saying it has not it is not an effort to do that. I'm just saying it's not a matter of fact at this point, or at least of reported fact rather than inference or suspicion that it is. I would also say just about Hamdi, you know, if I recall, Hamdi was captured along with the very large number of others in early 2002. I don't believe his name was publicly disclosed until the spring of 2002, after he had been gone through a whole lot of processing in Afghanistan-Pakistan region, been brought to Guantanamo. In the course of that processing, it is discovered that he is a U.S. citizen. There is then an interagency set of discussions about what to do with him. He is then transferred to Norfolk. And at that point, when the disposition is decided, at least a sort of medium-term disposition, that's when the disclosure was made. And so I think we have a sense of the Hamdi process as having happened very quickly, because the disclosure, we learned that he was in custody at the same time as his name was disclosed. But in fact, he'd been in custody for a while by then. And so I just think as a factual matter, it's not clear right now why the guy's name is being disclosed. And that said, I think your assertion about why it is certainly a very plausible and maybe even the most plausible explanation.
So I'll just say briefly on Hamdi. I mean, I certainly agree that there was a lag between when he turned himself into the Northern Alliance, when he made his way to Guantanamo, and when he was eventually transferred to Norfolk. I think the key for me is the amount of time that apparently lapsed between when it was discovered that he was a U.S. citizen and when his identity was revealed, you know, was not, I think, all that long in retrospect. retrospect. Now, maybe that's a sort of distinction without a difference. I guess it just seems to me that, you know, the government basically conceded once they discovered he was a citizen and agreed to, you know, sort of move him to Virginia, that his detention could and should be challenged in a federal court. Of course, the government argued vehemently against it on the merits, even suggesting early in the litigation that it was a non-justiciable political question. But they never said that it was beyond the sort of subject matter power of the courts, that Hamdi shouldn't have the right to at least try it. And so I agree, Ben. I am making assumptions based on the record about the sort of motive for not disclosing his name, but it's part of why I find this case troubling. If, you know, if we had known for 10 days, 2 weeks, even if we found out yesterday that John Doe's name was in fact, I don't know, Steve Vladek, you know, this would be a very different case to me, because then we would have the sort of normal wheels of judicial review easily set in motion. Instead, we're now going to have novel litigation in the D.C. District Court where a party that is a complete stranger to this detainee is going to have to try to convince a district judge that they have standing to litigate his detention on his behalf.
Okay, so let's move now from the factual landscape to the question that we actually really disagree about, which is how alarmed should we be about this case at this point in time. Start us off by making the case for alarm. Then I will kind of try to poke holes in the case for alarm, and I will then try to make the case against alarm. And then I want to close, if we can, with a suggestion that I have about a very easy mechanism to bring you to my level of lack of alarm.
I look forward to see if I can
convince you of it.
I look forward to you calming me down and talking me off the ledge. So let me sort of – here's what I think is the case for alarm. It is not that the tanks are rolling and that we are on the verge of another, you know, World War II era internment camp situation. This is not what this case is about. What alarms me about this case is the same thing that ultimately really depressed me about the Jose Padilla litigation. So Jose Padilla is a U.S. citizen who was held in military detention for 1,307 days from June 8, 2002 until January of 2006, and who never got a dispositive adjudication on the merits of his military detention, even though I think it was clear to most observers, at least by the time his cert petition got back to the Supreme Court in the fall of 2005, that there were probably five and perhaps even six votes on the Supreme Court to hold that the government did not, in fact, have the authority to detain him under the AUMF. And just to sort of show my work here, if one assumes that Justice Scalia would have hewed to his categorical dissent in Hamdi, and that Justice Breyer meant to join the footnote in Justice Stevens's dissent in the first Padilla case about agreeing that the merits of Padilla's detention were unlawful, Padilla was going to win. So, you know, here we have someone who was in military detention for 1,300 days, who never got a final adjudication on the merits of his military detention, and who ended up with, I think what, Ben, you and I would agree was a perfectly legitimate, correct disposition, which is to say transfer to civilian criminal custody, prosecution, and, you know, a very, very long prison sentence. What gives me alarm about this case is the specter of that history repeating, which is to say the prospect that you could have a John Doe detainee where, because the U.S. doesn't identify him and because it does not provide him with access to counsel and because it contests the ability of someone like the ACLU to litigate on his behalf, this litigation actually drags out for a while, whether or not the courts ultimately conclude that the government does or does not have the authority to detain him, right? That is to say, I'm alarmed by the specter of just how long the government could thwart, frustrate, or otherwise impede judicial review in a case like this, because I don't know what precedent that sets for next time. Indeed, one would have thought that the Jose Padilla case would have been a precedent for this time, except that it is no precedent. So, you know, my alarm here is not about the sort of implications of this case for everyday Americans on the street. My alarm is that I don't like setting precedents where the government can hold U.S. citizens for military detention for substantial periods of time, take steps to thwart judicial review of that detention, and then at the last second avoid even losing by transferring the detainee to some far less controversial disposition. You know, there's every reason to suspect that that's what's going to happen here sooner, later, or sometime in between. So that's the principal cause of my alarm is, you know, a combination of the government, you know, sort of raising obstacles to judicial review and the government having the power to then, even if it loses in the lower courts or even if it looks like it might lose in the Supreme Court, avoid actually losing and basically get away with what could have been, as might have been true in Padilla's case, 3.5 years of potentially unlawful detention of a U.S. citizen.
Okay, so let me ask you a few questions about this. First of all, when you say substantial periods of time, you cite one example of this, which is Padilla, which was, you know, really quite long. There have been a bunch of other U.S. citizens who have been detained in U.S. custody for varying periods of time, some vanishingly small. For example, John Walker Lind, who was detained, held in military custody quite briefly and then transferred to law enforcement. Some like Hamdi for, you know, about 3 years, you know, which is, a, you know, protracted, but certainly much less time than John Walker Lind. So when you say substantial, how small a period of time are we talking about before you're complacent about it? If there were a ceiling that said you knew John Doe was not going to be in U.S. military custody longer than X, you would say there are bigger problems in the world to worry about than this one, and you're going to think about other things. What does X have?
So I think it depends, Ben, on whether the evidence that is eventually provided goes a long way towards substantiating or calling into question the case for detaining John Doe. So to me, right, there's a difference here between how long can the U.S. hold a U.S. citizen, you know, captured in sort of some kind of combat-ish context overseas before they have to really, you know, go before a neutral magistrate and make a case to detain him versus assuming they can make that case, how long should they be able to hold him? So my sort of completely, you know, non-technical, non-sort of normative answer to the first question is 30 days. Right, that it seems to me that within 30 days, the government should have to go before a neutral magistrate whenever a U.S. citizen is picked up and placed in the military detention and say, hey, here's our probable cause or here's our at least preliminary showing for why we think we have a right to keep this guy in military detention. And at that point, maybe that's when, you know, the judge can reach out and make sure that there's access to counsel and so on, much as is the case under the presentment rules in criminal cases. You know, of course, in a normal criminal case, the presentment requirement's 48 hours. I have to think that 30 days would give the government time to remove the detainee from a combat zone, to ensure that he doesn't pose an immediate threat to public safety, and if he has significant intelligence value, to figure that out as well.
And is it 30 days?
If the government actually...
just to be clear, are you saying 30 days from the date of detention or 30 days from the date at which it's discovered that a given detainee is a U.S. citizen? Because this is a guy, at least as I read the New York Times story, who walks in, turns himself in. He's a dual national with a foreign, you know, with some other country. He's not a he did not grow up in the United States. He seemed to have been born here, very Hamdi-like, really, while his parents were here for some reason. And so I could imagine that he'd been in custody for quite a while before it emerges in the course of some interrogation that he's actually from Omaha in some original sense.
So I guess my reaction is I think it's reasonable for, you know, even assuming a 30-day clock, I think it's reasonable for that clock to run once the U.S. government knows or has reason to believe that the detainee is a U.S. citizen, because I think different rules would apply for a non-citizen. And so, you know, to me at least, the government really ought to be required within 30 days to provide the notifications to family members that would allow for judicial review to begin if the family members want want to pursue it. So to me, the harder question is, how long is reasonable detention without some definitive disposition of the merits? And I think that is a much messier question. And I think, frankly, you know, that is a question that is more about the subtleties of the Supreme Court's role in our system and what Alex Bickel, you know, famously called the passive virtues. I think the Supreme Court made a big mistake in Jose Padilla's case, in Padilla 1 especially, by using what was a contested and contestable procedural objection to avoid the merits when it was clear, at least to those justices at the time, what they thought the merits were. That said, I mean, given the vagaries of how litigation works, I don't think we can put a fixed clock on how long, you know, the review should take before there's some kind of definitive answer. I do hope that courts would be mindful of the Padilla, you know, legacy of the Padilla example in dealing with a future, or dare we say current, habeas petition from a U.S. citizen detained in comparable circumstances.
All right. So second question. Your example here continuously is Padilla, but it seems to me that this guy is much more similar to Hamdi, who, like this guy, was taken into custody abroad, who, like this guy, was principally a foreign fighter with a force that we were, or alleged to be, a force, part of a fighting force operating in a theater of combat, rather than Padilla, who was somebody who was alleged to have, you know, flown here as an operational terrorist on behalf of Al-Qaeda, whether he was actually capable of performing that function or not, but who was captured in a U.S. theater in law enforcement and then moved into military detention when law enforcement became an inconvenient or untenable basis to hold him. So my work and presumption when I see this guy's detention is that this is a detainee like any other overseas detainee whom we acquire custody over. And my working assumption is that those detentions are lawful unless I have some reason to think otherwise. Is your presumption that this detention is lawful for some period of time? Is your presumption that this detention is unlawful, you know, as until shown lawful? Or is your presumption that this is just simply an open question that we should have a litigation to determine?
I think that's a great question, and it's a great way to frame the problem. To me, at least, I think that there is no legal objection to at least some period of short-term detention in circumstances like these, and indeed that it would be really troubling if there were, because then there'd be lots of bad incentives on the government's part to use perhaps more force in similar and related contexts than we might want it to. So I have no aversion to the U.S. military in anything that looks like a combat situation, detaining folks rather than shooting at them for long enough to figure out whether they are subject to significant, substantial, medium to long-term detention. Here's my problem. To me, there is a subtle but critical moment that occurs sometime within the early period of that detention, and maybe it's 30 days, where the presumptions shift, where we're no longer talking about short-term battlefield incapacitation, but rather longer-term incommunicado military detention. And at least where a U.S. citizen is concerned, I'm actually quite comfortable arguing for a presumption against the legality of detention, and at the very least, a presumption in favor of judicial review, and that the government should not take steps affirmatively to thwart judicial review where citizens are concerned, where I think everyone would agree the suspension clause clearly applies. Now, Ben, you're right to point out the distinction between Hamdi and Padilla, and how, at least based on the, you know, reporting thus far, sketchy though it may have been, this case seems to bear more resemblance to Hamdi. But I say seems to because we have no idea what the facts actually are. The media is just reporting what they've been told by the Defense Department. And so, you know, maybe it's just that I'm a little bit more paranoid than you are, Ben. But, you know, why are we so confident that the facts are as they've been described by the government, as opposed to, you know, a more complicated case with messier facts where it wasn't quite so obvious as a U.S. citizen walking up to the SDF and saying, I want to turn myself in? That's my concern. In my, you know, I realize this might sound like a very sort of romantic academic view of the courts, but the reason why we have habeas is to make sure that the facts are as the government tells the media they are, especially in a context where there's been no opportunity to develop the other side.
Okay, so let me turn now to making the case against alarm, and then you can have at me for that. Here's my basic view. First of all, there's a lot of common ground between us, notwithstanding the apparent disagreement in our exchange on Lawfare. And the common ground is as follows. You are not convinced this is unlawful, what's happening. And I am similarly convinced that there should be early access to a meaningful habeas process to resolve any legal difficulties that there may be. And I am certainly not arguing for any kind of protracted government effort to frustrate judicial review in any way. And in fact, we'll finish this by my proposing what I think could be a joint proposal to resolve this on a basis of facilitating judicial review. That said, here are the areas where I think we genuinely do differ. I start with the presumption that, like Hamdi, this is in all probability a legal government activity. That is, if we are dealing with an enemy combatant, and we generally at least for some period of time, in the first instance, defer to the military's judgments about that. We've had, you know, hundreds of thousands of detainees, or more than 100,000 detainees in the Iraq and other theaters since the advent of post-9/11 counterterrorism, and very few of them have been subject to judicial review. And so, you know, the normal course is to understand a detention under these circumstances as lawful. The second normal course is to understand that while indefinite in the sense of not having a fixed time frame for release, like, for example, a criminal sentence, indefinite does not mean forever, and it often means for quite short periods of time until we figure out what to do with the person. So my first working assumption is the military took custody of a person, and I don't have a basic problem with that detention. And unless I see a reason to particularly have anxieties about it, I tend to think of it in the language of Hamdi, not in the language of Padilla. And the language of Hamdi is, it's lawful, but he gets process and habeas as a backstop against whatever process deprivations there may be. And so the second broad point is that there are two things that really do give me concern here. One is that, for the reasons you've articulated, the withholding of his name really does set up a situation in which you could imagine some frustration of that judicial process. And the third is that while I'm not at all worried that the Trump administration is going to use this as a chest-thumping way of reviving Padilla-like domestic enemy combatant detentions, I am worried and have been since since the Obama administration, I am worried about the situation in which somebody gets stuck in this seam, and that we, you know, the whole system is designed or functions to put pressure on people not to hold U.S. citizens in military detention. For example, you know, Hamdi worked out really badly for the government. Padilla actually also worked out badly for the government. This is a guy who should be in prison for the rest of his life, and he won't be. He'll be in prison for 20 years, but he's going to get out, and he's going to get out and be a free person. And based on the conduct that it is reasonable to believe he did, although not the conduct that he was convicted of, you know, the government actually paid a real price for holding him in military detention rather than dealing directly through the criminal justice system. And similarly, if you compare John Walker Lind to Hamdi, Hamdi got a windfall for not being in the criminal justice system. He was home in 3 years. John Walker Lind got a 20-year sentence. And so I think there are a lot of built-in incentives for the government to resolve this in a sensible way that doesn't lead to any of the bad outcomes that you're describing. And yet I am concerned that someone can get stuck. That is, you could imagine a situation where he simply doesn't cooperate enough with law enforcement and they don't have enough other admissible evidence to prosecute him. But they do have enough information to hold him in military detention. And they don't want to let him go because he's scary for some reason. And so that ends up becoming you end up backed into a situation where you get a more protracted military detention than is attractive. I'm concerned about that, but I'm not, but unless I see that situation developing, I'm not in the alarmed stage about that. Finally, there is one other factor that I think will genuinely push the administration to resolve this either in the direction of transfer to some other government or toward transfer to law enforcement. And that is the ISIS question, which is, you know, the administration's position about ISIS under the AUMF, which I think you and I would both agree is not optimal and not laughable. And if it would be a kind of legal malpractice, I think, for either Defense Department or Justice Department lawyers to too blithely allow that question to become justiciable by litigating a detainee case. And so for all of those reasons, I am confident that this will be relatively short term. And the one area that really gives me anxiety is the anonymity of it, because I do agree with you that theoretically that could provide a basis for a lot of procedural litigation to frustrate judicial review. So that's why I think there's a lot of common ground between us, and I'm less alarmed than you are.
It seems to me that the principal sort of point of disagreement here is comfort / predictive judgment of how these cases will go on the merits, right? That is to say, if you are of the view that the odds are somewhere in the ballpark of 95% to 98%, that if and when the time comes, even if it's not the optimal context in which to litigate this merits question, the government is going to prevail, then I think it's easy to not be alarmed by the sort of hiccups of, you know, awkwardness of trying to sort of frame the case in a manner that allows for the court to do what it does. And I guess the principal focus, the principal sort of source of our disagreement is I'm just not as confident in the merits, because I think the merits assumes something about the facts, right? And when the government is holding one of its own citizens in incommunicado detention, I just don't know why we can be nearly as sanguine that the facts are as they've been described. Hamdi's case is a really good example of this. I mean, for as much as I've been talking about Padilla, let's talk about Hamdi for a second. In Hamdi's case, Hamdi was turned over to the U.S. by the Northern Alliance at a time in that conflict when we were paying substantial bounties to the Northern Alliance and similar groups for every single person they turned over to us who met certain criteria. I would think that the fact that we were paying people for bodies would have led to some natural skepticism that Hamdi was in fact someone who we could have detained. And in fact, you know, as Ben pointed out, when push came to shove, rather than actually give Hamdi the hearing the Supreme Court held was required, right? The government enters into this agreement to send him back to Saudi Arabia in exchange for renouncing his citizenship and various other things. So, you know, I guess I'm not as confident as Ben is that in these cases the government is right, and that therefore, you know, opportunities the government seems to avail itself of to forestall or at least delay judicial review are simply hiccups as opposed to, you know, preventing a U.S. citizen from vindicating his right not to be detained without charge. I still think that, you know, these cases are sufficiently scattershot that, you know, we're not talking about a World War II type situation, that this is not something where there's a grave structural injustice. But I'm really uncomfortable with the precedent here, because what is to stop the government next time from taking a U.S. citizen off of a plane at some foreign airport and holding him, you know, sending him to Iraq and saying that they can hold, that they don't have to tell you who he is because of whatever reasons they're going to invoke in this case, right? That is to say, if this gets upheld, right, if the ACLU is unable to convince Judge Chutkin or the D.C. Circuit on appeal that they should be allowed to proceed on John Doe's behalf, I think that's actually a very dangerous precedent, and I guess I'm not confident that in, you know, sticky situations in the future where the government is faced with similar pressures pulling itself in different directions, they wouldn't look at this precedent and say, well, let's at least, you know, sort of slow things down and keep the sort of our options open for as long as possible. I don't know what government wouldn't. So this is why, to me, what really makes this case alarming is actually the anonymity of it, right? If the government had already identified John Doe, if we were already proceeding to the merits of his habeas petition, if we were having the discussion of, you know, on the facts as alleged by the government, does it have the authority to hold him under the AUMF, then we'd be back to sort of the good old-fashioned fight of Hamdi. This is different from Hamdi, and this is different from Padilla, and I just worry that, you know, if the government is able to prevail on the procedural questions here, that would be alarming in as much as it sets a precedent for potentially, you know, ignoble government officers in the future to do nefarious things.
Well, to be clear about one aspect of that, I mean, the government hasn't even made those arguments yet. There has not been, at least not to my knowledge, a government brief that says the ACLU is not a proper next friend, right? So,
Ben, do you think the government is going to concede that the ACLU should be allowed to bring this habeas petition?
Well, so I would assume that they will not, but I don't want to impute the argument to them until they've made it, because I'm allowing the possibility that they're actually doing this for reasons other than frustrating litigation. I don't want to accuse them of acting to frustrate litigation that they haven't acted to frustrate yet. And so I'm perfectly willing to suspect that you're right, that we're going to see such a brief. But I don't think it's fair to or reasonable to hold them accountable for a brief they haven't yet written.
Well, I mean, I take the point. I guess I just, you know, color me as very skeptical that the government would concede. And in any event, I mean, I think it's worth stressing to listeners a sort of technical nerdy Fed Courts point. A concession by the government would not be dispositive, because whether the ACLU has next friend standing here is a jurisdictional question the court has to resolve anyway. So, you know, I guess I'm both less confident than Ben is that the government isn't going to – well, I shouldn't say you were confident. I guess I'm more willing than Ben is to impute to the government an argument it hasn't made yet, and also in any event convinced that this question is going to have to be decided whatever position the government takes on it.
Okay, so I want to throw out to you in closing – an idea for how to resolve this principal anxiety of yours in a fashion that will bring you closer to me in the alarm scale. And that is that the Defense Department has said that the detainee in question has been permitted to meet with the ICRC. The ICRC frequently will notify families as to a detainee's existence and safety and status. And so my question is, why shouldn't the judge simply ask the government whether the government will waive ICRC confidentiality to allow the ICRC to provide access to the detainee or to relevant actors in the bar who might be interested in representing the detainee and might notify them of the family's identities so that if the detainee wishes to have a next friend, there is counsel and family counsel available to do that. And it can be the ACLU if that's the ACLU and the detainee's choice. Or it can be, or that family members who can act as the next friend to the extent that they want to can choose to do it. And that way we can circumvent the question of whether the ACLU is a proper next friend simply by asking the government if it is acting in good faith here to make sure that the entity with access to the detainee in fact has the ability to make sure that he's represented to the extent that he wants to be.
Allow me to offer a slight counterproposal, which folks who listen to this week's National Security Law podcast have already heard, which is I have qualms about going through the ICRC because I'm very nervous about situations that might put the ICRC in a conflicted position vis-a-vis the government and the detainee. You know, to my mind, the ICRC's value comes from the fact that it never has an obligation toward the detainee as such. But I think, Ben, you could get to the same result and, you know, sort of abide by even the most sort of narrow readings of the relevant Article III doctrines if a district judge in a case like this ordered jurisdictional discovery, that is to say, limited discovery for the purpose of determining whether she has jurisdiction, i.e. whether the ACLU has standing, and that as part of that discovery, the government be required to notify John Doe not only of the pendency of this habeas petition, but of the fact that the ACLU has claimed to represent him and to ask whether he consents to having the ACLU or some other lawyer he can identify represent him in court. I would be confident that under penalty of perjury, the government would comply with such a request if it didn't choose to appeal it. And the answer to that request, I think, would go a long way towards settling the ACLU's next friend standing. The virtue of that, to me, is if the government, if the detainee does say he wants to be represented and the government still has a compelling case for keeping his name a secret, the court would know that the ACLU has standing. The case could proceed, I think, at least to some degree with the detainee's name protected, and we'd actually get to the merits. So I think, Ben, you'd get to the same place. I think it puts the ICRC in less of a fraught position and is more consistent with how these kinds of analyses usually occur. You know, there's some precedent for this. Folks might remember the Abu Ali case where Judge Bates ordered limited discovery into deciding whether Abu Ali, a U.S. citizen, was being held by Saudi intelligence officials on their own authority or at the behest of the United States, because Judge Bates thought the answer to that question was conclusive of his jurisdiction over Abu Ali's father's habeas petition. To me, that's the model that I hope Judge Chutkan uses here to sort of balance existing doctrine with really the equities of ensuring that if John Doe wants his day in court, he gets it.
You know, the Abu Ali case was complicated because, first of all, we never found out whether Judge Bates's ruling was appropriate because the government suddenly produced Abu Ali in the United States under criminal indictment.
Perhaps thereby vindicating the central claim of his habeas petition.
Well, I mean, you know, there is no doubt that that he was in Saudi custody and that they were cooperating closely with U.S. Law enforcement. And there's similarly, there was, but I'm not sure the idea that he was in constructive U.S. custody was ever vindicated. But my, you know, I heard when you made that argument on the National Security Law podcast, and Bobby's response, which I thought was interesting, was why not just have a show cause order as to his having the ability to file on his own or have an appropriate next friend. And so my question is, could we agree on that the burden is on the government to, if it wants to argue that the ACLU is not an appropriate next friend, to show that it is not precluding litigation by withholding his name, and leave the specific mechanism, whether it's discovery of the type that you're describing or an ICRC role, or simply Jim Mattis picking up the phone and calling the guy's family and saying, by the way, we've got your son, and if you want to file a habeas case, you're allowed to do that. But that there's got to be some mechanism by which the family is alerted and that he's alerted that he's got habeas rights.
I think we agree. I think the source of our sort of non-material disagreement here is my sort of fealty to Fed courts doctrine that I don't necessarily agree with. So it's black letter law in the federal courts that the burden is on the party asserting jurisdiction to establish jurisdiction. And, you know, I'm just nervous about suggesting that the burden ought to be on the government to disprove jurisdiction in this context because of its potential doctrinal implications. It seems to me the way to avoid doctrinal traps here is to leave the burden where the doctrine places it, to wit, on the ACLU or whoever else is purporting to be John Doe's next friend, but to give the ACLU an opportunity through jurisdictional discovery to carry that burden. And so, you know, I lean toward my version, not because I think it's normatively more desirable or defensible, but because I think it will be less of a sort of shock to existing doctrinal rules to go that way. And suffice it to say that, you know, I'm consistent with my view of the importance of this case reaching the merits as soon as possible, you know, I'm trying to sort of push for whichever doctrinal solutions are the least likely to create questions of first impression on appeal.
So I want to close with the following prediction and your reaction to it. Number one, the case is going to go away all of a sudden, either because he's transferred to law enforcement or because he's transferred to another country. And number two, I will respond to that by saying, see, I told you so, no big deal. And you will respond to my response with a frustrated, but no, it really is a problem because.
So I completely agree with one. The case is going to go away. He's going to be transferred to another custody, or he's going to be indicted in a U.S. criminal court. That is to me an inevitability at this point. The answer to two, Ben, depends on when that happens. So if it happens tomorrow, you're going to say, see, I was right, no big deal. And I'm going to sort of say, well, it was just 5 weeks. And maybe we can hold our nose and grin and bear it. If it's 5 years from now, and you say, see, it was no big deal, I suspect I'm going to have a lot of folks agreeing with me that you're wrong. And then the million-dollar question is, at what point between tomorrow and 5 years from now do we cross over from this not being a big deal to this being a big deal? All I've been trying to say all along, in my initial post, in my tweeting, in my response to you, is that it is not nearly as obvious to me that this doesn't become a big deal for years and years and years. You know, every day that passes, I think this becomes more of a story. Even if we all agree that what you suggest as the result here is inevitable, you know, I think there's a real difference, not just for John Doe, but for future John Does, whether that reality comes true sooner rather than later. And the later it comes true, the more I think I'm going to be right.
Steve Vladeck, thanks for joining us. It is a pleasure to have the experience of disagreeing with you over a detention matter once again. It's the good old days.
Happy days are not really here again, but it certainly has me remembering to a gentler time where the debates were somehow different.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare Podcast, share it on Facebook, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.